Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Light at Lavelle by Paulina Simons, narrated by Jill Winternitz.
Fate whispers to the warrior, "You cannot withstand the storm." And the warrior whispers back, "I am the storm." Unknown. Prologue. One warm summer evening, in a tiny hamlet south of civilization, east of the wild mountains, west of the Black Sea, a beautiful young woman named Isabel cooked and baked and decorated her house for the wedding of her friend Cece to her brother, Roman Lazar. When she was done with the house, Isabel decorated herself. She put on a red dress and 5 heavy strings of coral beads. She wove silk ribbons through her hair, pink and orange and yellow, and she made a flower wreath of mallow and magnolia and fitted it over her golden mane, the color of a Karabakh mare. The large family had labored long, toiled from the first hour, and now the work was done, and soon it would be time for a well-earned banquet. The tables were fully laden for the high festival. The harvest had not been good that summer, but that didn't matter, for nothing was spared to honor the pair about to enter into holy matrimony. Roman, a spectacular groom in an ultramarine blue shirt and black velvet trousers, rode in on Boyka, his beloved Palomino stallion, and Cece, a beaming bride in embroidered white, adorned with peonies and roses, was swept up into Roman's saddle to circle the village church 3 times before they were crowned husband and wife. The korovai had been baked, and the gorilka brew made with extra honey and peppers. The poppy seed cake, the pamplushki, the kutia, the shish kebabs, and the stuffed cabbage were all laid out like offerings. Isabel's husband was on the fiddle. Her younger brother accompanied him on the accordion, and her mother played the balalaika. Isabel's youngest brother was wrestling with her sons over in the dirt by the trees, where the 3 of them must have thought Isabel wouldn't notice. They drank to life and rejoiced in their good fortune. They bestowed the newly married with their gifts and their pleasure. They danced the Ukrainian wedding march, the fastest bridal polka in the world. They danced the Kolomeka and the Hopak. The music never stopped, and the homemade brew flowed freely. And, Boje me, it was strong. It was a wonder they made it till morning. The wedding began at 11 and continued through the night, and sunrise was like dusk, incandescent indigo and pink. 4,000 miles away from the Lazars and their all-night worship of the power outside the physical world, separated from Isabel by space, but not by time, Finn Evans hired Paul Whiteman and his 15-man orchestra to play live on stage at the exclusive Somerset Club in Boston. Paul's band drove up from New York for one night only to serenade Finn and Vanessa's 7th wedding anniversary. Everyone else in America listened to Whiteman through the little speaker on their living room radio. But here in this room, the king of jazz himself, in a white tux, stood on stage, the gold of his sax glistening, the gold from his sax floating through the air like tenor confetti, while Finn danced with Vanessa. White linen and lilies covered the tables, and the handsome crowd wore their Friday night best, their hair immaculate, their silk dresses shimmering. The food was exquisite, from the cold lobster to the freshly made bread, from the clam chowder to the cod and scallops, all of it divine. The music drowned out hundreds of sober voices, sober because there was no wine, no moonshine, nothing but bloodless apple cider and virgin mint juleps coursing through the veins of the revelers. A regretfully sober, yet joyous, Finn whirled in a waltz with Vanessa, his hand delicate on the small of her back, their guests looking on approvingly. Finn, too, was approving. His wife was a regal platinum vision, and the world he had built with her so concrete. It was as if he had hammered a perfect David out of a block of shapeless, unforgiving marble. Such was life, measured by value, by time, by place, by space. It pressed upon them from all sides, and though Finn and Isabel did not yet know it, feasting sumptuously in their corners of the vast world and spinning to the sax, fandango, and the fiddle, they were already at the precipice. Book 1. The Sword of Damocles. Part 1. The Vanished. Conceal me what I am, and be my aid, for such disguise as haply shall become the form of my intent. William Shakespeare, Twelfth Night, Act 1, Scene 2. Chapter 1. Cici Lazar and Her Stories. Ukraine, February 1929.
They killed them. They killed them all.
Isabel looked out the window to see the tiny Cici atop the massive Boyka galloping up the sloping hill. High above her, a sedge of gray cranes, long-necked and mighty-winged, flew in a broken formation. Jumping off the horse before the mount stopped moving, Cici ran into Isabel's house. Not just ran, but sprinted, as if she had something great and important to announce that couldn't wait another second. Isabel wanted to say, "Tie up Roman's horse," but before she could speak, Cici flung open the door, cried the words above, and bent over, gasping. Isabel was almost 29 years old, fair-haired, fair-eyed, fair-skinned. She was lean and strong in the way women are who live on a farm and work all day. There was only one mirror in her house, and she often went weeks without glancing in it. She brushed her teeth, washed her face, smoothed and braided her hair, got dressed, put on her boots, and began her day without once considering what she looked like. She knew. Only on Sundays did she put on a few airs and a pretty dress. Sometimes she left her hair down. In the summer, put flowers in it. But often she didn't catch a glimpse of herself, even on Sundays. And today was not a summer Sunday. It was a Tuesday in the dead of February. Isabel set down her wooden spoon. She had been frying potatoes and eggs. It was 7 in the morning. Mirik had come in after loading the milk canisters into the dray. In the winter, they made their deliveries right after sunrise. The light was still low, the sky a hulking gray. Until Cici burst in, the cottage had been quiet. Isabel's boisterous boys were down in the barn with Isabel's mother. Talk about the blind leading the blind. Oksana was a good teacher, engaging and level-headed, but a terrible dairy farmer. However, Isabel's children weren't allowed in the stables with Roman anymore, not after he allowed the boys to ride 2 untamed foals without a saddle. Now, only the inefficient but safe grandmother was allowed to supervise them. Isabel's husband came to stand next to her as they stared at Cici panting. Mirik Kovalenka was 7 years older, a serious man with a stern nose, kind brown eyes, and a composed manner. He wasn't much taller than Isabel, or much bigger than her in build. His light brown hair was thinning, and he needed glasses, but wouldn't admit it. Cici was still gasping, but not because she was out of breath. "Killed who?" asked Isabel.
"Who is they?" asked Mirik. "And who is them? Cici, speak sense."
"Stan and Vitali," Cici said.
Stan and Vitali Bobich were Cici's cousins.
Someone killed Stan and Vitali?
No,
cried Cece.
Stan and Vitya ambushed a squadron of Soviets coming down the road and shot them. I don't know if they were council members or OGPU. Stan is convinced they were Czechists.
OGPU were the Soviet Internal Security Forces. Colloquially, they were referred to by their post-revolution name, Czechists, from when the secret police was called Cheka.
But either way, they killed them all. Maybe 4 dozen men.
Isabel and Mirek half relaxed. Cece was known, espace over, for her fantastical and far-fetched embellishment of facts. And Stan and Vitali were not exactly famous for their intrepid military ingenuity. They were potato farmers who liked to drink and get into stupid trouble.
Our Stan and Vitya shot 4 dozen soldiers,
Mirek said in his slowest, most skeptical voice.
That's right, Mirek.
Cece was adamant.
And they were walking, these 50 officers,
Mirek said.
Not riding in military vans with loaded automatics?
They were walking, yes.
In the middle of the night.
It wasn't a question.
Yes,
said Cece.
I am witness.
You were up in the middle of the night, in the middle of the woods, and saw Stan and Vitya shoot a company of Soviets. It was Isabel's turn to sound incredulous.
No, by the time I heard about it and got to the woods, it was over.
Ah, said Mirek.
I saw the last of them being thrown into a mass grave,
said Cece. Isabel and Mirek exchanged a glance, less relaxed, but still skeptical. What do you mean by the time you heard about it? Isabel said. How could you possibly hear about it? Weren't you next door with Roman, sleeping together like husband and wife? I just left Roman at the stables. He mentioned nothing about this. Cece waved dismissively at Isabel, as if to say, don't bother me with nonsense.
Roman slept at home, if you must know everything. And I was at Tamara's.
Why?
Why? Who cares? We had a fight.
About this?
Isa, did you not hear what I just told you?
Oh, I heard. Isabel really hoped Cece was exaggerating, because otherwise, their simple life was about to get a lot less simple. When she first saw Cece racing up the hill, the girl had looked so much as if she was bringing good news. Isabel thought maybe she was pregnant. Now, Isabel knew the truth. Not only not pregnant, but burying communists in ditches, apparently.
Cece, this story of yours is getting more and more marvelous, said Mirek.
He was always calm.
Please, tell us more,
he said.
We have all the time in the world. It's not like we have work to do or milk to deliver.
Isabel elbowed her husband. She was not always calm. But she remained calm now because she didn't want to believe Cece.
It's fine, Isa,
Mirek said.
It didn't happen, so there's nothing to worry about. Is my food ready?
You don't believe me?
Cece said.
Go see for yourselves. On the other side of Ispas, on the road to Kamenets, just past the Grey Rock.
Kamenets was the closest city to their hamlet.
Now, why would all those Soviets be coming to Ispas all of a sudden?
Mirek said.
You know why,
Cece said, her voice laden with meaning. The rumbling through the countryside was getting hard to ignore. The Soviet food procurement units had been sent out into the Ukrainian villages since December. The cities didn't have enough to eat. It had been a fallow summer, and an empty winter. "Look, let's all pipe down," said Isabel. "We don't know who they were."
"Or even if they were,"
said Merrick. "We don't know what they were. Soldiers or requisitionists or just propagandists," Isabel said. "We don't know if it was 40 men or 3.
"It was 0, said Merrick.
"It was 4 dozen, said Cece. "You don't think I know the difference between 3 soldiers and 50? I saw the bodies with my own eyes."
"Cece is right about one thing, Merrick," said Isabel. "Whoever it was, and however many, if they were walking down the road in darkness before dawn, that's not a good sign. No one creeping into a village in the middle of the night can be up to anything good." But Isabel knew and didn't want to say. If Cece was telling the truth, and Stan and Vitya actually killed Soviet men, that was even worse.
"The Ukrainian loves a good story," said Mirek. "Isabel, is my breakfast burning? Because there's work to do. The milk will go off before Cece is finished speaking."
"Please say you're making it up, Cece," said Isabel, peering outside her kitchen window for a glimpse of she didn't know what.
"I'm not. I know sometimes I like to tell a tall tale or two, but trust me, Isa, this is not one of those times. Look at me. You know I'm telling the truth."
Raven-haired, raven-eyed Cece was a minute, slightly rounded girl, but she carried herself high and mighty, as if on a plinth. Cece had always been a raging ball of fire. Part Romanian, her heart all gypsy, she was impulse and flame.
"Still don't believe me? Ask my husband. He knows."
"Oh, now he's your husband," Isabel said. "A minute ago, you weren't even sleeping in the same bed." "Don't humor her, Isa," said Merrick at the stove, spooning his own potatoes from the cast iron pan onto a pewter plate. Cece shook her fists.
"Both of you, get your heads out of the ground."
"Oh, I would," Isabel said. "If only the Soviets weren't supposedly in that ground, rotting in a shallow grave."
"Who said anything about shallow?"
said Cece.
"Our boys dug practically to Australia. They dug that hole like it was the most important hole of their lives."
"And the ground looks freshly dug, like a grave?" asked Isabel.
"They're not idiots. They covered it with twigs and leaves."
"No, of course," said Merrick. "Not idiots."
He wolfed down his potatoes.
"Merrick, you heard what that Kramar from Shatava told us who ran through here last week,"
Cece said.
"The Soviets arrived uninvited and unannounced, upended his store, and took nearly all his provisions. He had to abandon the village and flee. That's why Stan and Vitya reacted as they did."
"If that's the case, what's their considered plan?" said Merrick. "To lie in wait every night waiting for more Soviets? That's the problem with Ispas. Too far out in the Khluhi Doki to have any sense. We have a village full of cavalier clowns with a few rifles and even fewer bullets. We can't fight the OGPU or the Red Army, Cece. We couldn't beat them 10 years ago when we were better organized and better armed, and we're not going to beat them now. We'll give them some milk. We've done it before, and they'll be on their way."
Cece got quite worked up.
"Merrick, they're not coming for just your milk this time," she said. "They're coming for your cow. They're coming for Roman's horse."
"Yeah, good luck with that," muttered Isabel.
Merrick, who didn't get worked up about much, turned red in the face. He waved his dirty spoon at the two women.
"So what are you going to do? follows Stan and Vitali's lead.
They want to come here? Let them, said Isabel. This is Lazar land. We have my three brothers. We have Yana, who's worth 10 men, even though she's expecting a baby. We have me. We even have you, Mirik.
Thanks a lot, wife.
And me, said Cece. Yana was a warrior. Cece, a wannabe warrior. A Lazar by marriage lies in the same bed as her husband, Isabel said, adding. But fine. And you too. She turned back to Mirik. We have rifles. We have shotguns. We have horses. That's a cavalry, husband. And Roman even kept some grenade sticks from the war as souvenirs. The war was the Civil War of 1918 to 1921, between Bolshevik Russia and Ukraine.
Yes, and you know what else we have?
Said Mirik, wiping his mouth.
Because you seem to have forgotten. Two small sons and our feeble mothers. We can't be waging another war with the Soviets.
Who are you calling feeble? Said Isabel's mother, Oksana, who had just walked inside. And who are you calling small? Said 9-year-old Slava, Isabel's firstborn son, black, curly-haired, and round-faced. Slava was the word for glory in Ukrainian, as in Slava Bohu, glory to God.
Yeah, Papa, who?
Said Maxim, Isabel's second son, who was a blade of long grass like his mother. They called him Max. He was 8.
Decade-old grenades and two enormous boys, Mirik said, his hands on his children's diminutive heads. Yes, Mama. We're unbeatable.
Chapter 2. The Banker. On a sweltering evening at the end of August 1929, an evening Finn thought was like any other, he left Adams Bank and Trust on the corner of Washington and Winter and began to amble home. As he passed Jordan Marsh, the luxury department store, purveyors of silk, wool, and finery, he allowed himself a satisfied glance at his reflection in the glass windows. He was pleased with himself, though his mind was distracted. The bank's quarterly profits, to be released to the investors at the end of September, had been made available to him that afternoon, and they exceeded his most optimistic expectations. He had increased quarterly revenues by 70% over the year before, contained operating costs at last year's levels, and kept the default rates at a minuscule 2.2%, the lowest of all the banks in Boston. Finn invested heavily, diversified the bank's holdings, spread wide the nearly non-existent risk, and greatly increased his capital, both personal and professional. The returns had been phenomenal. So much so that for the last 12 months, Finn had been investing the bank's deposits chiefly on margin. Buying stock on margin allowed him to multiply the bank's profits, not just exponentially, but geometrically. Because of this, Finn was able to offer his depositors the highest savings rate in Boston, which in turn attracted more customers. When Finn started at the bank in 1921, they had barely 500 depositors. Not even a decade later, they were about to break 5,000, and their total deposits were nearing $17 million. Walter Adams, his father-in-law, who owned the bank, was as pleased with Finn as Finn was with himself. Thus occupied with his successes, Finn strolled languidly past City Hall. The walk home was a favorite part of his day, especially on these waning Fridays, when everyone in Boston knew the winter freeze was just around the corner
and took advantage of the balmy weather. Finn and Vanessa planned on taking the girls to their cottage on Cape Cod to prolong for one more weekend what had already been a mostly blissful summer. Finn liked seeing himself as he appeared to other people. He had just turned 31. He was refined, groomed, tailored, not a wrinkle on him. His dark blonde, thick, naturally unruly mop of hair was brushed all the way back and kept under strict barber discipline. He had a glint to his blue-green eyes and a humorous bend to his expressive mouth. The humor he also tried to keep under control, as his wife was often not amused by his teasing. He was over 6 feet tall, which he liked, and broad, which he liked less, more demolition man than jockey. But one could only do so much with the card one had been dealt at birth. His custom-made suit slimmed him, made him appear every bit the elegant businessman he aspired to be. He kept his large frame in trim shape by walking up and down the steepest hills of Boston, admiring himself in the welcoming glass and assessing his life. And life was good. Finn had made it so. He had made it what he wanted it to be, made himself into the man he wanted to be. Well-raised, immaculately educated, beautifully mannered, bespoke, smooth-faced, though that 5 o'clock shadow was never far. He had a wife, 2 girls, all 4 parents still living. His mouth twisted at that last thought, but one would have had to look really close to notice. Catching his long stride, his imposing size, the drape of his light gray coat, the straight back that had never bent over wheat or needle, Finn turned his gaze from the window and walked on, counting his blessings. Chapter 3. Lemonade. The first time Vanessa Evans, nay Adams, began to suspect there might be something wrong with her, she was 8 years old and feared she might be allergic to lemons. This made her melancholy, because she loved all things lemon. Lemonade, lemon meringue pie, lemon bars, lemon ices. She loved lemons so much that the mere possibility of being unable to enjoy the food she loved best made her distraught. This, in turn, made her determined to prove that she was not allergic to her favorite thing. So she continued eating lemons and distracted herself from feeling unwell by thinking about something else, so she wouldn't have to acknowledge the gnawing pain in the middle of her body. First, she tried thinking about something else, and then she began doing something else. When she was 8, she systematically and fastidiously pulled the petals off all the daisies in their garden. That's how it began. That was 22 years ago. Now there was no going back. For the most part, she had led an idyllic, charmed, protected life, which was appropriate for someone who looked like her. She was the ideal of female beauty. She wore clothes well, had a pleasing smile, slight hands, a kind demeanor, and a great sense of fashion. There was nothing wrong. All her life, her mother and father told her so. The perfect child with perfect manners. The perfect daughter, sister, student, friend, and dancer. Vanessa deserved nothing less than to make someone a perfect wife and continue to live a perfect life. She met Finn when she was 18 and he was 19. He was in his junior year at Harvard. They had a whirl of a summer together, but in November 1917, he went off to war. He was gone 18 months. And when he came back, he was a different man. Vanessa didn't know how or why, but the silly, happy, romantic boy she had danced with and walked through the public garden with was no longer present in the wounded and decorated, serious man who returned to her. Some secret burden cast a shadow on Finn's every smile and every...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?